This episode of Does Not Compute is brought to you by Storyblocks. Whenever you need stock photos, videos, or audio, Storyblocks has got you covered. The Storyblocks library has over 400,000 images, 150,000 videos, and 100,000 audio clips, and you get unlimited access to them for one flat yearly fee. Unlimited stock media means no more worrying about stock budgets or having to skip using a great image because of the cost. You'll always be able to find the perfect accompaniment for whatever you're making. Everything on Storyblocks is royalty-free and can be used in personal or commercial projects. The Storyblocks library is also continually growing, so no matter how many assets you use, there's always something fresh. As a special offer for Does Not Compute listeners, Storyblocks is offering 1 year of unlimited access to all three parts of their library for just $149. Head to storyblocks.com/doesnotcompute to learn more and sign up at that special rate. This offer is good through December 31st, 2017, so make sure to check out Storyblocks today by visiting storyblocks.com/doesnotcompute. Yeah, so this is the first time we've been living in the RV for something like 3 weeks now, but this is actually the first time I've ever recorded in here, and I'm really excited. We finally have internet in the RV.
Your internet or?
Yes, like our actual internet. This is, I'm currently talking to you over a cellular connection. It's with a company called Unlimitedville, and they have deals with, or supposedly, they say they have deals that are actually legitimate for truly unlimited data with all the major carriers. And so I'm running on the Verizon network here, and I only have two bars here, but I'm getting like 12 megs down, 6 megs up-ish, generally. So it's great.
That's not bad. Unlimitedville, that's what it's called.
Unlimitedville.com, yes.
Interesting. I might have... Nah, I don't need any... Nah, I'm not going to do that. It sounds very nice, but I have no need for such a thing at this current point in time.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly excessive in terms of cost compared to other internet options. Like, we're paying $250 a month for Verizon, but... I mean, the fact of the matter is, if I want to travel around the country and work as a software developer while I'm doing that, I kind of need good internet.
Right. And what you're saving in other areas too, so it makes sense.
San Francisco rent.
Right. I'm paying $130. No, it has to be more than that. Maybe the same. I have two lines on Verizon that have unlimited data. So maybe it is around $230 maybe.
Something like that. Sounds about right.
Probably similar. It sounds like we have very similar plans, but it's nice that it's expensive. Yeah. But it's the peace of mind knowing like traveling and such that you'll always have, like you're never going to get stuck because we're traveling. We're going to be back out in California this summer in Southern California for a few months. And it's just nice to not have to depend on coffee shop Wi-Fi or gas station Wi-Fi, or God forbid truck stop Wi-Fi. Especially if you're traveling full time. So it's expensive, but it's one of those things, especially in our industry, you kind of need to be connected.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing is, it's kind of crazy. I've found myself going down this entire rabbit hole of what unlimited data really is and who's offering what, and all these different plans are always changing. There's actually an entire like subculture and submarket of people who make their living, or part of their living at least, having grandfathered Verizon unlimited data plans that are still on contract and then reselling those to people, but they don't advertise anywhere except on like member only secret forums and stuff, so Verizon doesn't find them and get shut down. And then they'll have bandwidth limits so you don't get on automated detection things that Verizon is setting up. It's truly ridiculous trying to get actual unlimited hotspot data, but I think we're there now,
hopefully. I especially with like the recent net neutrality discussions and things happening in that space, I don't want to say I have a pessimistic outlook on it. I'm of the mentality of like everyone's always lying all the time, and that's just kind of how I cope with it, I guess. Like, I just assume everyone's lying all the time. Oh, we have unlimited data. No, you're lying about that. But you know, everyone lies all the time, so that's just how it is.
Yeah, it can't bum you out if you expect it.
I expect to be lied to all the time by everyone. and yeah, it doesn't bum me out as much, but It's just one of those things. It's kind of funny also, a little bit different, but when I was talking with, I think I have Spectrum, who's owned by Charter. I see Charter vans all the time, but technically I'm paying Spectrum for internet, not Spectrum Chat, but Spectrum, the internet company. And I was trying to increase my connection speed. Sometimes, like, I'm paying $75 now. It went from like 60 to 75 because the intro offer expired, of course. And I haven't had the urge to call them and negotiate because I could probably get in another introductory rate introduced.
Sure.
Yeah. But the last time I called them, basically, so it went like this. I was like, hey, so I'm looking online and you guys offer two speeds. You have 60 down and 5 up, and you have 300 down and 5 up. Do you have any plans that offer more than 5 up? And after a few rounds of conversation with their tech, he basically said to me, anything you want to do within reason, you can do with 5 up. Which to me, he was insinuating that I wanted to do some nefarious things with my more than 5 up connection. And I was like, excuse me, that's not true. So after that, I just kind of was like, I don't care about it enough to have to deal with, because he got really hostile. So when he said that, he was basically insinuating that I was trying to pirate a bunch of stuff and distribute content illegally, which
thanks to our sponsors, Spectrum Internet.
Yes. And I was like, thanks, guy. So that caused me to, there apparently, so I live in the boonies, right? And so apparently there's a fiber internet company out here, but that's a whole thing because you have to call them up. You have to say like, yeah, I'm going to commit to getting your service. Then they have to talk to your landlord. You have to submit a form to your landlord in writing saying that your landlord gives permission for them to like come and knock around on the walls and stuff and look at the power poles and all this other stuff to make sure that all the connections are available. And if they have to upgrade anything, you know, you have to pay for that. But it's a whole thing and it takes weeks for it to happen. And so I started the process and I was like, you know what, this isn't worth it because I don't have enough. I'm just too tired to deal with all of that. And fiber might be nice, but my brother has fiber and he's not getting what he pays for. There's always problems with it. They kept on telling him he had to buy certain brands of routers and certain brands of this and that because not all of the stuff in the market supports a fiber connection. And it was just a whole thing and has continued to be a whole thing for him. So I just didn't want to deal with it.
Yeah, fiber can be a giant mess, especially sometimes you'll have to dig trenches and it can get
so
super time consuming and expensive.
It's kind of a hilarious story, but it was weeks for him. So he ordered it and they kept on coming out to his house and they're like, okay, we need to do this next. And then it would be a while. And then they would call him, some supervisor would call him like, hey, we're pleased to announce to you that, you know, this part of the process is finished and you should be ready to go when you get home. He gets home and, his speed would actually had decreased by a third or two thirds. And he was like, so what's the deal? So he gets home and Rachel, his wife was like, hey, yeah, they called and said everything's good. And he was like, well, that's funny. Because this whole time they were telling him they were going to run a cable and they had to run, it turns out that they actually had to run a cable under the highway across the street from his house or like outside of the little cul-de-sac he lives on. So they're like, yeah, the cable ran and everything's fine. And he was like, that's funny because when I pulled into the cul-de-sac, I saw the cable rolled up and tied up to the stop sign. So they had in fact not dug anything. They just rolled it up and tied it to the stop sign and it was just hanging there. God. So I didn't want to have to deal with that.
Yeah. Internet service providers, man. I've been thinking about this a lot since I'm going to be fully mobile. It's kind of amazing how much having good speed internet just completely changes what it's like to live in a place. Cause when you sort of think about it, the big issue with living out in the middle of nowhere historically has been either high latency or mm-hmm. lack of bandwidth. And I don't even mean those just in the internet sense. So let's say 150 years ago, it took a really long time to send mail to somewhere remote.
Right.
It was incredibly, incredibly high latency and very low bandwidth. Then you get things like telegraph and telephone, which drastically reduced the latency, but still had major bandwidth restrictions. But now you can watch live videos out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's also, I don't know, I have, I guess I'm of the opinion, I shouldn't really say that I think that Wi-Fi and internet access should be like a public utility, but it almost, it's like used as one, right? So people pretty much everywhere get most of their news via the internet or via a cellular device of some sort. They get, they do a lot of learning, like they do a lot of communicating all through that stuff. And it's also interesting increasingly that cable companies or Wi-Fi companies, when they offer phone services, most of them are VoIPs now. And it's, we're just more and more dependent on having internet access and having a stable internet connection. And talking to some other people, talking to some people that work in like the forest industry or the parks industry, and talking about talking to people that have gone through like earthquakes and things in the past, they're talking about how dangerous that is because it's not as reliable as a hardwired connection, I guess. So it's actually something I've been thinking about a lot the past few months, like trying to figure out how to become less dependent on one source, right? Because if Charter goes down, I have Verizon, and that's fine. So I'm kind of split up into to two different areas where I can basically communicate with people and send information out. But some people, they don't have a redundancy there. They just have only one option.
Yeah, yeah. And kind of going back to what you were saying about it being almost like a utility in a lot of ways, I mean, yeah, that's something I worry about too, especially with all the discussion around net neutrality. And like you're saying, everybody's always lying, right? And when when everybody's always lying and there's no guarantee of a truly public internet, a truly open and accessible to everyone internet, that becomes really scary, especially with what we saw in like the elections last year with so much misinformation being spread and these companies really abusing things, Facebook and Twitter selling ads to all sorts of Russian special interest groups and whatever, all this kind of stuff. That's super, super concerning. And I don't have a great answer for it, but man, I've been thinking about it quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't either. It's funny because I watched that. I think it was Al Franken that was asking the chief counsel for Facebook. They were just kind of grilling him, and I watched the video, and he was like, "Well, how, you know, we basically weren't necessarily aware that was the Russians that were buying these ads." And he was like, "Sir, they paid in rubles. They paid you in rubles," and it was a whole thing. But yeah, it's. I try not to think about it too much just because it adds some stress to my life. But yeah, it is kind of concerning because I don't know. It always just comes back to that. Like there's always going to be someone trying to get one up on someone else. There's always going to be someone trying to take advantage of somebody else. And there's always going to be someone that's not telling the truth so they can keep what they have that other people don't. And it sucks, but I guess I've kind of accepted that's how it is, and is my like that. It's kind of a pessimistic outlook, right? Because as much as I want to believe that people are good, you know, there's a lot of great people out there, but there's also a lot of not great people out there. And if you choose to kind of stick your head in the sand and be like people are inherently good and everything will work out, it's not. It just doesn't work that way.
Right. Well, and I mean, even all those good people, it's really easy to build something super evil with the internet, even kind of by accident. Yeah, like you can accidentally do that, even with the best intentions. And I think that really does come down to developers in a lot of ways to be like, to really be mindful about what it is you're actually building and what it could be potentially used for. And try to put safeguards in place to prevent that to the extent possible, at least. I think there really is sort of a moral responsibility on developers there.
Yeah, and it can be hard. Obviously, having a job is important. Having a livelihood is important. And it would suck if your boss came down and said, you need to build this thing, and you objected on moral grounds. You know, there goes your job in most cases. It's just hard. I'm pretty sure I was I was browsing around news this morning and I saw an article, or I saw the headline rather, that said that Comcast was injecting JavaScript into web pages. Again, I don't know if it ever stopped, but I know that's sometimes a common thing. And it's just, what's funny is it did not surprise me at all. I was like, that makes sense, and just kept scrolling.
The first tech job I had, I'm sure we've discussed this before.
Yeah.
But yeah, my first tech job, we basically did that.
Yeah.
We injected JS payloads so your ISP could serve like an ad or some sort of like a billing notice or something on top of someone else's website. I no longer work there, and thank God for HTTPS.
Yeah, right. Thank goodness for VPNs, and I'm really happy that things like that are becoming more popular and more ubiquitous to the public. I think there's a long way there. I think, you know, what's interesting is that more and more people are into, they have an idea of what a VPN is, or they've heard the term, or they know some company that offers that service, but they don't necessarily know why they might need it. And so, I mean, education is coming a lot farther. You know, organizations like what's the people that make HTTP Everywhere, the Chrome plugin, the ETF.
Is that EFF?
Right? Yeah, EFF. That's what it is. They're doing a lot of great work. What was interesting was I was hanging out in the bookstore in town, and there happened to be a guy visiting who was a sysadmin. And so I would go in and get coffee. I usually work there in the afternoon just to get out of my place. And we would just kind of talk tech stuff for a little bit. And this was right after the big WPA2 bug was exposed. And so I was like, oh, hey, did you hear about this? And he was like, what? Because he's a sysadmin, right?
Sure.
He was like, what? And so we were talking about it. And someone that was working at the coffee shop overheard. They're like, so what is, you know, like, what is all this stuff you're talking about? Because it sounds not good. And we kind of broke it down, and I could tell she was kind of mind blown about how easy it would be for people to get information, like get your information, if they really wanted to. Like, most people aren't protected very well or not educated in how to protect themselves in the area. And she was like, she it was kind of one of those things where they're drinking coffee and then the coffee cup never makes it to the mouth. They just kind of like stop and hold it in midair.
Yeah.
But it was like one of those things. So we had talked about, it never came to fruition, but we had talked about even doing a presentation on the college campus. You know, just doing an informational thing, like, here's how you can protect yourself, here's how you can protect your information, and all that stuff. It's just, yeah, it's cool that it's becoming more common knowledge, but it's definitely needs to be taught more. It needs to be put out in the forefront more.
Well, it needs to be taught more, but it also needs to be, again, I think it comes back down to the people who are building these things. End users shouldn't have to think about security, mm-hmm. because they're non-technical users in most cases, and they shouldn't, that shouldn't be the responsibility. Really, the burden should be on whoever's making the services to make sure that the services are secure and do keep people's information secure. And iMessage, for example, I think one of the best examples of this. Apple is just doing the right thing. Full end-to-end encryption. Yep. They can't access it. And it's just, I'm very glad, at least, that there's a lot more HTTPS, a lot more green locks, and that the browser vendors are actually warning users when mm-hmm. things are insecure in more cases. I think those are two really big and important steps.
Yeah, and I think
it's ridiculous for people. It's ridiculous to expect, like, a random phone user to understand all of the privacy implications of connecting to various Wi-Fi networks and mm-hmm. using sites on public Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff. It's just there's no reason that they should have to ever think about that even.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to design and marketing, messaging, even like mostly even copywriting too, because I feel like a lot of I think it was Signal. Is it Signal or Telegram? I can't remember. There's a bunch of different like encrypted messaging apps out there. When they first came out, I felt like they were really targeted towards the tech audience because the terminology used in it was very much, if someone that didn't know looked at it, they still wouldn't really know. They would, okay, I can send messages with this, but I don't know why I would use it over something that I already have, like iMessage, or Maybe WhatsApp is a really good example of this. They, you know, they're another example of someone that has end-to-end encryption, and they just did it. You know, they have all these users. They didn't make a big fuss about it. It's just something that is a part of the system.
Right. It shouldn't. It shouldn't be a marketed feature, really. It shouldn't have to be.
Right.
It should just be the expectation. It should be in any service, mm-hmm. pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Any service that deals with any sort of sensitive information or potentially sensitive information, at least.
Yeah. And then I don't know. And even when I look at all of that stuff, it's still in the back of my mind. The VPN companies are lying to me. You know, so I'm trying to like read for and look for reviews to talk about, oh, surprise, these people keep really detailed logs or whatever else, you know. So it's just one of those things.
That's the thing too, because even if a consumer does take the time to educate themselves on why they might want to use a VPN, they might not even think about the fact that there are still humans running that VPN service.
Right.
And you actually do have to be careful who you pick.
And there's still humans running the service, and those humans are still being contacted by people that are putting pressure on them or trying to lobby them, really, I guess, into doing what the opposite of what they should be doing. It's
or even beyond that, they're just fallible humans,
yeah.
who could make a completely honest, legitimate mistake.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a scary world, true. Sean.
Yeah, it is. That's why I try to remove myself from it as much as I can, like especially with Design Collective, specifically thinking about the accounts that I use in the back ends and stuff, two-factor everything. All my passwords are in 1Password. Even database backups that I have on my system. So every day I have a reminder. I should probably automate this at some point, but it works for now. I have a reminder that pops up and I type in one command into my terminal and it downloads a copy of the database at that point. And I drop it into Spider Oak, which is Dropbox, but it's completely end-to-end encrypted. So even data like that, I'm not even though my laptop is encrypted, I have the, what is it, File Vault on. Even all that stuff is encrypted. I'm even storing those backups in another layer deep just because I'm so paranoid about that stuff.
Yeah, you can never have too many backups.
You can never have too many backups.
You mentioned that you have everything in 1Password. If any of our listeners are currently not using 1Password, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is probably the least replaceable app that I have.
Right.
So it's that good. I use it constantly for everything.
It's the first thing I install on every computer. Well, second, yeah, first, the
it
first
has
thing,
to be.
The first thing I install on every computer.
Because otherwise, else.
Yeah, I can't install anything else without it. What's interesting though is I've been using TunnelBear for my VPN. I've used Cloak, which turned into EncryptMe, I think it was. Yeah. And then I was using Nord, which I was having some trouble with. So I'm using TunnelBear. And TunnelBear is coming out now with a TunnelBear themed 1Password, essentially. So I thought that was cool because TunnelBear to me is by far the most user-friendly VPN you can get into. It's the easiest. You literally click one button and it's connected. That's it. And
plus it has cute bears.
And it has cute bears and it works really well and it doesn't break all my stuff. unlike other VPNs I've messed with. But yeah, so they're actually building a 1Password type setup as well, which looked pretty cool, which I was excited about. A lot of people I saw, I think it was maybe like Hacker News or Product Hunt, I don't know. People were just kind of like, "Oh, why would you make this? There's already 1Password." And I was like, they should go ahead and make this because they already have a user base and the user base probably needs something like this if they're not already using 1Password.
Right. Well, and I mean, competition's good. It'll make both of them better.
It's good. Yeah. So I can't.
That really is.
Good.
That really is step one, though, for any sort of security. Like you can have all the VPNs and secure messaging apps you want, but unless you're using a different, really long, randomized password for every single service, you're just nothing else you do matters. You're so vulnerable.
Yeah, it's necessary. I end up anywhere I go, I end up talking about 1Password. I feel like
they deserve it. They've earned it. Like I've been using it for, geez, I don't even know how long, six years or something, 7 years at this point, and I use it every single day, and it is absolutely invaluable. And the great thing is now they have the this is like sounding like an ad, but they've got their family plans now, which I'm actually on. So I have my wife is on there, and we have shared passwords and for accounts that we both need to access. And it's so easy.
Yeah, I have one as well. And I have Jamie on it, and my mom and dad are also on it as well. So in other news, this is pretty cool. I shipped my first feature using PostGIS.
Ooh, that's awesome. So you were talking to me a little bit about this. I didn't know you had it actually out though now. So you're finding out, you're asking for a user's location, and if they provide it, then you're showing them the stores closest to them, basically?
Yeah. So the whole premise of Design Collective is trying to help support local shopping and help support local businesses. And so really what we've been working towards a long time is getting something like this out the door, because when someone from the area, most of our users come from the Southern California area, which is where all of our stores are. We want to show them the stores that are physically closest to them first, because most people, when they're shopping like that, they don't mind going to the store. In fact, we've had a lot of people say that foot traffic has increased as soon as they join the platform, which is really encouraging to me. But also we get a ton of messages. People are using the support chat thinking they're talking to the stores, which is another thing I need to address. So I get questions all day long, like, what are your hours? Even though, you know, a store might have it in the description, or do you have this in whatever material, or can I customize this product or whatever? But a lot of people are saying, they're not even asking questions, they're just saying, hey, I'll drop by tomorrow, or I'll drop by next week, or I'm in the area in 2 months, I'll swing by then, you know, which I thought was also kind of interesting. So yeah, I'm using PostGIS to get the user's location if they provide it. If not, we just have a list of predefined cities that we're exposing. So that way users can, if they have the question, where are all these stores, or where is the bulk of these stores located? There's just a select there that shows them. But we're filtering the list returned by the API by the physically closest store first.
That's super awesome. And you should put the query you're using in the show notes. It's basically like a one-liner. It's so straightforward to do, and it's all happening at the database layer. So it's just, that's so cool.
So fast. Like, there's not a noticeable increase in latency or anything from the API at all, which is amazing. You know, I'm sure that once scale picks up, there'll be some things we need to address. But for now, it's like, it's not even noticeable.
You were able to ship it without having to make any sort of concessions or
no.
Big performance changes. Sure.
No, all I did was I wrote a migration to enable the extension. And then I added, so Ecto is really cool. It makes it really easy to just use raw SQL functions in line with your Ecto queries. So there's a function called fragment, which takes a string and a list of, the term slips my mind, but so
in well-known text.
Well, the string, yeah. So the string would have like a question mark, and like it takes a list of placeholders that would get inserted into the question marks and your fragment. So really what I'm doing is I'm storing points. So I'm storing a WTK or a WKT. I can't remember. I'd have to look at it.
WKT.
A WKT encoded point. I'm storing that in a database, and which has an SRID and then the longitude latitude. And so I'm storing those, and literally all the function does is that you give it a second point, and you give it a store and a second point, and it'll return to you how far away the second point is from that store's location. So
as the crow flies, right?
As the crow flies, yeah. And what was cool was I set this up, and then I pulled up Google Maps, and I used the measuring tool, and it was within the standard deviation, and which is, I mean, it's accurate enough for me. So
right, it doesn't have to be perfect. You're not guiding missiles. You're just showing people where stores are
relative
to their location.
So really, implementing this feature, the bulk of it was like learning what's an SRID, what does Google Maps use when they return to me longitude, latitude, what should I be using, how should I store this. Once I figured out those things, actually writing the function was literally 30 seconds. I just take the WKT points, and I cast them into a geography point, which is a PostGIS function. And then I call a PostGIS function called SDDistance, and that returns to me meters between the distance in meters between the two points.
So cool.
It's crazy that it didn't cost me any money. It didn't cost us any additional money for this. Like, because I looked at using something like Algolia, and maybe like in the long run, we might end up switching to something like that, something more powerful than Postgres keyword plain text searching, which is working fine. And in fact, that stuff's all implemented the same. I just have a fragment that calls the Postgres match function, and then orders by similarity. Like, that's all it was to kind of have a mostly keyword based search. And it doesn't cost us any extra money. It didn't like require me to bring in a new dependency beyond PostGIS, which, you know, I had already installed, because when I installed Postgres, my Docker container, it already had PostGIS. And Heroku already comes with that out of the box, you know, so all I had to do was enable the extension and we were off to the races.
So cool. I love that there's so much power in, especially in Postgres in particular. It's got so many extensions for so many different
goodness.
Things that you can just, you just flip them on. And then you have all this awesome functionality still at the database layer, really where it belongs in most cases.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And without any external stuff. It's so cool.
Yeah. And it doesn't, like, the crazy thing to me is that, it just doesn't cost any extra money. Like, obviously I think open source is really cool, but this to me is like a whole nother level because I know next to nothing about, projection based systems. It's like when I started reading about it made me tired because I was like, there's so much stuff I have to know. And the cool thing was a few people reached out to me on Twitter because I sent out a tweet saying like, please help, send help. And people would DM me and are like, hey, what do you need to know? But really that was the cost, was me tired for 2 days and then like writing a function in 30 seconds and just being like, oh, it works. And the way that Phoenix's view setup made it really easy to work everything in too. So the way the API works is that there's a key that is returned in the store objects that's just distance in miles. And there will also be like a distance in kilometers as well eventually. But if you send a location parameter with a longitude latitude point, then that just gets inserted into the response. So if you don't send a location parameter, then the store objects don't even have a distance in miles. Returned. So that way we handle cases where maybe some stores, we haven't geocoded all the stores yet because some of them didn't have all the information saved. And that's only because I just updated the address form in the store admin to be a view component. When you change the address, it uses Google's geocode API to get the longitude latitude. And so I can't actually save all those stores because they don't have all the required information in the form. I could totally do it on the back end, but I was kind of
right.
In a rush.
You just need,
to get this
you
out.
Need them to, right? Sure.
Yeah. So if a store doesn't have a point saved on their address, then they're just shuffled to the back of the pack.
Well, that's a good incentive for them to get one added.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was just so easy, man. The whole thing was just so easy. Once I really looked at it. I mean, there's going to be other things that are going to need to be taken into account. Like when we say, show me all the stores closest to, Hermosa Beach, for example. Well, Redondo Beach and Manhattan Beach sandwich Hermosa Beach. And so if I'm using the city center that Google gives me for Hermosa Beach, a store that's on the outskirts of Redondo might actually be closer to the center of Hermosa Beach than a store that's on the other side on the outskirts of Hermosa. So it might be confusing to users if they choose Hermosa and the first store listed is like 0.2 miles and it's in Redondo Beach, if that makes sense. So there's things like that, like kind of UX things and copy things that need to be taken into account that I just don't have the answer for, you know? So I'm sure someone's going to ask and I'm going to be like, well, technically it's correct, which is a terrible answer to give. That's like the worst answer. Technically it's right because the store is
kind
closer.
Of correct.
Yeah. But
I'm a programmer.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I hate giving those answers because it makes me feel, because it just makes other people mad. You know, it makes them frustrated. But I just was super excited about that because to me, it was like a very complicated thing that provides a lot of practical information to our users, you know, and I think it'll help the stores as well because people are like, oh, this is only a half a mile away. I'm just going to go there. And that means that right. The store can meet the person, they can upsell the person, that, you know, they can make a real relationship with that customer.
Well, and the customers are going to win there too, because it's a big, anytime you're making a big furniture purchase, you want to go try the thing out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You want to
You don't want to buy
couch.
A couch without
you
sitting
jump on
it.
You want to jump on it a little bit. you might want to kick the side. You want to have your dog scratch on it a little bit to see if it breaks.
Definitely spill some things on it. These stores are going to love their customers.
Right. But I think maybe even the biggest thing of all is that we're working on a feature where there are, like, stores can opt into free shipping within X miles. And so that way we can actually show, hey, if you shop at this store, the shipping is free. Boom. I mean, people are going to shop there first. I know, yeah, I would, yeah. Because shipping furniture,
especially for furniture. Yeah.
Yeah. It's huge. So that was an example of something that I thought that was really cool, where it was like, I didn't know how to tackle the problem or how I was going to tackle it. I started researching PostGIS, learned a little about it, implemented it, and shipped it in less than a week.
Yeah. It's always, whenever I really take the time, we say this almost every episode now, but it's like, really take the time and plan things out. And then the actual work is so much easier. It's a different game.
Yeah, yeah. But if anyone knows anything about Postgres, hit me up. Hit me up, because I don't know a thing besides how to cast a point to geography point and then use SD distance.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I got to get back to working on this RV.
Oh, yeah.
Building a spice rack today.
It's like owning a ship, right? Like, I guess owning a boat is, it's never, the work's never done.
In that I feel like I'm constantly sinking, yes. Talk to you later, man.
See ya.
Thanks again to Storyblocks for sponsoring today's episode of Does Not Compute. Storyblocks provides unlimited access to their library of over 500,000 stock assets, which includes photos, videos, and audio clips. They've got a special offer for Does Not Compute listeners. You can get a full year of unlimited access to the library for just $149. This offer ends December 31st, 2017, so head to storyblocks.com/doesnotcompute to learn more and sign up.
Cut out.
I think you cut out.
Is that my Wi-Fi? there we go. That's what I'm talking about. We need to have redundancy going on in my place here.